Greetings again, everyone. I am here today to scotch rumors. I am here today to tell you that my wife is not running for the vacant Senate seat in New York. And I am not running for president. And neither is Hurley nor Stan. We're not running. But almost everybody else is. NBA basketball players, professional wrestlers, real estate developers, multimillionaire magazine businessmen, anybody and everybody who has any kind of notoriety or fame, especially in the media. People have been suggesting that Oprah ought to run for president. And should she do so, I'm sure she would win. She has declined. She doesn't want to run, and that was a relief. But on the other hand, if she had run, I almost have no doubt that she could have won. When I was a much younger man, standing in a pulpit to the Feast of Tabernacles in the 1950s, I used to say, look at what was coming on the United States and with regard to the Great Tribulation and the suffering of God's people just prior to the intervention of God in human affairs, that America would be at its lowest ebb at that time, and it wouldn't surprise me a bit as I looked at Isaiah 3 and verse 12, as for my people, children are their oppressors and women rule over them, that we might have a female president by the time the tribulation struck. Well, you all know why Hillary is running for the vacant Senate seat in New York, don't you? And it's been openly debated, by the way, on television call-in talk shows, so I'm not revealing anything new. Many people know that her strategy, in addition to please don't send me back to Arkansas, is saying, I would like to get that Senate seat, make a big name for myself, introduce a lot of maybe health care legislation, all that stuff, and then in 4 years or 8 years, run for the presidency and get Bill and I right back in that White House, if she is still with Bill by that time. And so there's been an awful lot of talk about it. I cannot avoid it on television. It seems like every program, especially on the weekends, is talking about who has an opportunity, who has a chance, who is going to be a shoe-in. Will Bradley somehow unseat Gore in the Democratic convention? Will George Bush be elected? Or now that some of these other people have thrown their hat into the ring in the Reform Party, thank you very much, Reform Party. You have given us Gore, in my opinion, but that may not be right. That's exactly what happened when, as they say, the little hand grenade with ears created the Reform Party several years ago. And everybody began voting for him, and those votes were pulled away from the Republicans, not from the Democrats, and so we ended up with 8 years of Bill Clinton. Well, by law, Bill Clinton is going to have to go back into the private sector somewhere or another, and apparently they want to go back into New York. We've just recently returned from the Feast of Tabernacles, and we know that during those days we were acknowledging the fact that we as new creatures in Christ are dwelling in a temporary tabernacle until the time when Christ returns to this earth to rule it with a rod of iron. And the whole issue is one of government. How best to rule? How should people live? How should they conduct their affairs? Should government have anything to say about family life, about education, about personal health and welfare, about such issues as abortion, or about such issues as your, well, the HMO thing that they get into now with which doctor you can go to, whether you have a right to choose the doctor of your choice, or whether you have to go to one that the government says you've got to go to. And they are going around and around, Buchanan, George Bush, Elizabeth Dole, Steve Forbes, Donald Trump, Al Gore, Bradley, and their claim to fame is notoriety and being in the public eye. And there's much ado now about this guy who is Jesse Ventura. I think of all men, he probably is the most qualified because after all, his entire professional life was a complete sham. When you think about it, a professional wrestler is an actor. I'll tell you something you've never seen. You've never seen it. If you can stomach it, if you can stand it, thank you very much. Congratulations. I cannot. But in those few little vignettes I have seen, just to look at the ludicrousness of this activity and just amazed that there's a big crowd of screaming people there. You will never see a professional wrestler grab another wrestler and take three big jumping steps and throw him into the ropes and have him get thrown into the ropes face first. He will always turn his back, lean against the ropes, and catapult himself across, and of course knock the other fellow down, won't he? You've never seen a professional wrestler, and you never will, hit the ropes with his chin or his jaw or his mouth agape and, you know, give him a wider smile. Nothing like that is ever going to happen. They always turn and lie back against the ropes and then spring on their opponent. So when you have a guy with this real hoarse voice from all the shouting he did and the shaved head and the great big weightlifter's body, I guess only the folks up in Minnesota, bless their hearts, were able to do that, but that's because no other professional wrestlers have ever run for governorship that I know about, or for the presidency, which is now a very great possibility. Only in America. Seems like only in America. You just shake your head at what goes on in some people's mind. Now, the only thing I know about Donald Trump is that he is for divorce and gambling. I know nothing else about the man. I know that he is for divorce and he's for gambling because he is the builder of huge, big gambling casinos in, I guess, principally in Atlantic City, maybe in other places, I don't know. And he's a multi-millionaire, if not a billionaire, probably a billionaire. So there's no telling who else is going to throw his or her hat in the ring, but I wanted to just scotch a rumor that my wife Shirley is not going to run. Well, I want to talk to you about government a little bit, and I want to go back to the Table of Nations in Genesis, the 10th chapter, to do so. Because from the very beginning of men getting together in groups, there was an attempt to amalgamate, to coalesce, to gather together in a very tight-knit group, and to be ruled or governed by one man. About 6 or 8 years ago, I delivered a sermon entitled, Just One Man. I probably ought to dust that off and redo that, or simply do one like it at some point in time. And because I was referring back to dictators and despots, the likes of everyone from Nimrod himself, all down through history, to Antiochus Epiphanes and Ptolemy Soter, and the Caesars of Rome and Alexander the Great, if you study his life, you'll be absolutely amazed at the brutality of men like Attila the Hun, at Hannibal and his brother Asdrubal, at some of the great figures of history of more recent date, such as Kaiser Wilhelm, Adolf Hitler, Stalin, Pol Pot, Saddam Hussein. Men like this who at the snap of their fingers with a delicious grin on their face can actually lower some character who tried to overthrow them into a bath of acid and watch them scream while they die, which is exactly what Saddam Hussein did. He murdered his first man when he was but 16 years of age. And when you stop to think about just one man, with whatever appeal he has to his own people, to a constituency, to whatever degree he is able through his charisma and probably through a spirit and spiritual help and spiritual influence, to therefore influence the minds and the hearts of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands or millions of human beings, to the point that they so identify with that one man that they are quite willing to give their lives for him. Now, this is man's history. All down through history, it has been so. That's how incredible it is and ironic, to me at least, that we have you've heard about the new automobile they're coming out with in Canada. It's called the Dodge Drafter. Because Canada is the place where an awful lot of young Americans went to avoid the Vietnam War at a time when a particularly kind of cotton-haired American was over in England, and then he went over to Russia, and he went to Europe, and he was demonstrating against the American involvement in Vietnam, and he said, quote, "I loathe the military," end quote, who then became the commander-in-chief and ordered our young men and women into Panama and into the Gulf and into Kosovo and other places where any number of them got themselves killed. It's an ironic twist of history that that could be so, but it is nothing new. Henry VIII, I don't care who you talk about, if you look at a despot, at a despotic ruler, including the man I used to call Infidelito, and then I won't give his last name the way I corrupted it, but Infidelito Castro is... Because infidel is different from fidel. Fidel means faithful, but infidel means, as you know, unbeliever. But anyway, Castro is still with an iron grip over the land of Cuba, and they got a big flap right now because the Cuban Band, which is kind of a rock group, is coming supposedly to Miami, and the city fathers and other people are now clashing with the federal government. It doesn't want that to happen because of the very large Cuban refugee element there, and they don't want that concert to go on because they hate the government of Cuba. In the 10th chapter of the book of Genesis, we find what is called the Table of Nations. The generations of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, verse 1, after them were born sons following the flood. Then it lists the sons of Japheth and the sons of Ham and the sons of Shem. Now, notice in verse 6, the sons of Ham, and Ham is the progenitor of all the black races. Cush, we believe the modern Cushites are more of the East African highland blacks, especially those of Ethiopia and Eritrea. And Mitzrayim and Put, who may be the East Asian Indians. And Canaan, and remember, Canaan was black. Many people pass over that fact. The problem between the Canaanites and David and the Israelites and so on was a black-white or a Ham-Semitic problem, as well as a political or a war problem. The sons of Cush, it lists all of those. And Cush begat Nimrod, verse 8. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Eternal. Some people have tried to say that that meant in place of, or in substitute of, or that he was standing for the people as a great commander of armed forces. What little bit of sketchy history, and remember that most history is looking through the dumps and the refuse piles and the garbage heaps of old civilizations. That is available in Babylonian cuneiform. It was assumed that he was the first builder of any kind of a city-state, of gathering people together in Africa. They called them kraals, K-R-A-A-L-S, from which we take our English word corral. They would put huge thickets of thorn bushes and grow them so close together that the lions and so on could not get in to get at their herds and their goats and at the people. And they gather together for protection against wild animals. Well, there were plenty of lions, you know, even during David's day, if you read the Bible very carefully, in the land of Palestine. And Palestine looked in that time, for all the world, like Oregon does today. There are conifers in Palestine. If you go up into the heights where I've been many a time, and up around Nazareth, where Jesus grew up, there are pines and conifers, firs, and various ones, many different varieties. Well, there were lions, and there were other very ravenous animals, different kinds of wild cats and so on, in that land then. He was a mighty hunter before the Eternal. And because of who he was and what he did, I think the preferred understanding of that is not that it was in the eyes of God or in the sight of God or God beholding him and approving of his works, but the other way around, that like a supplanter, people, instead of looking to God, they began to look to a man. They looked to Nimrod. Wherefore, there was a slogan, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Eternal. So there was like a chant or a cheer or a slogan that they used to identify this man. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel. If you look in the margin, that says Babylon. And it takes its name from what happened there. And it was called that because that's where the tongues or the languages were confused and divided. And Erech, which was Uruk, and it's one of the two most ancient city sites known to all of man. And by the way, the footsteps of mankind lead away from the Middle East in all directions. They do not lead away from the Olduvai Gorge and Zinjanthropus africanus, discovered by Dr. Leakey. And that's an appropriate name. And Akkad and Kalna, and in the land of Shinar, or the plain between the two rivers of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. Out of that land, as it should read, he went forth into Assyria and built Nineveh, which was the capital of Assyria, and the city Rehoboth and Calah, and Rezin between Nineveh and Calah, the same as a great city. And then it goes on to mention all the rest of these people. Now, go to the 11th chapter and verse 1. The whole earth was of one language and one speech. As a result of that, now you know that what divides humankind today are primarily, you got to deal with all of it, and of course the world is shrinking because of instant telecommunications and global satellites and all of that and rapid travel. But prior to that time, what divided the world was primarily the oceans, the continents, the great huge land masses, and the mountain ranges which separated tribes and peoples, rivers, bays, estuaries, natural geological phenomena, and then most of all, color, race, and language, and dress and culture. If you look at someone and you might normally want to communicate, but you can't even talk to him, you tend to be afraid of him. People were afraid of one another. They couldn't speak to one another, and so they hated one another. But the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. And it came to pass as they journeyed eastward, as it should read, because Adam and his progeny were cast out of the Garden of Eden, and they journeyed toward the Babylonian plain. You tend to think of that, I think, as a desert, don't you? You know, one point they brought up, if you should have seen some of the movies, or rather some of the television, when we were clamping, and still are, the embargoes upon and sanctions upon Saddam Hussein, and yet you would see business going about on a daily basis in the streets of Baghdad, and here were these incredible flea markets just laden with every kind of vegetable you can imagine. Because the overflowing of the one river to the other, and north of the Shat el Arab, which is that part that is not navigable, but where most of the world's date supply comes from, it's very fertile, very arable, green and verdant, and the part that gets more rain between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers is very well watered. You know, it comes all the way down from the top of the Anatolian peninsula and the Pamir Knot. And those are long, long, long rivers. They may not be the same rivers that are mentioned prior to the flood because the entire topography was changed at the time of the flood, and it mentions that there were four rivers, of which only two have been found anyhow. But the Tigris-Euphrates river courses could have very dramatically been changed while the entirety of the tectonic plates were buried beneath the waters, and then when they came back up, it could be different rivers, but with the names attached to them that were attached by the people who were in the ark with Noah previously. So with that quick comment, that is a very verdant, a very fertile area that is able to produce a tremendous amount of food. And one way that the American government couldn't hurt them was in foodstuffs, because they, like an agrarian society, are virtually self-sufficient with regard to fruits, vegetables, dates, nuts, and all that type of thing. They don't have to import them. In Iraq, I'm talking about now. It came to pass, as they journeyed toward the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar. That's the plain that we're talking about in modern-day Iraq. And dwelt there. And they said one to another, go to, let us make brick, and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone, and slime, or bitumen, as it should read, for mortar. And they said, let us build a city and a tower, whose top may reach unto heaven. Now, let me dispel a totally false concept that some people had many years ago. They were not trying to get to heaven by the tower. They couldn't have been that stupid. Why do it in the midst of a plain when you got mountains going up to 22,000 feet within about a 2 weeks journey, for pity's sake? And you could go to the Himalayas at a Pamir Knot and other places. You got mountains all around that are 16 and 20 and all up to 22 and 26,000 feet. So they were smarter than that. They're not going to try to build a tower that gets to be 10 or 12 stories in the middle of a flat plain at about 350-foot elevation above the sea to get to heaven. What it was a tower which might reach into the heavens. The word I think I've told you before in Spanish for a skyscraper is a skyscratcher. It's rascacielos. Para rascar. Si rascar mi hombro, mi brazo, is to scratch my shoulder or my arm. Rascar. Maybe we get the word rascal. I don't know. But rascacielos. Cielos, or seal, ceiling. Cielos, you hear that? Cielito lindo, beautiful little sky. In Spanish, is the heavens. So, skyscratcher in Spanish. We say, ridiculously, skyscraper. Well, it does no such thing. But we call them skyscrapers in New York and in cities where they have great 100-story and plus 100-story towers that may reach up into the heavens, and let us make a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. So we need a national identity. We need a national symbol. We need some kind of a national symbol which indicates maybe the father of the country. And what more appropriate symbol to put there than the symbol of fatherhood? Other nations have followed along with regard to that. So we took Cleopatra's needle as a type and we erected a great huge monument to the father of the United States. At the end of the mall, you can see it clearly from the Capitol building, and it is an exact replica of an ancient Egyptian obelisk. And an obelisk was intended to represent something. I'll leave that to your fertile imaginations. So they made such a gigantic tower. It was a kind of a tower you could not only go up into it and survey all your domain, but you could look at it and you could see it coming over the foothills and the mountains from maybe 60, 80 miles away. It would be an awe-inspiring monument. Now also, they needed a sign or a symbol, and they needed a name. And so they came up with some kind of a name, and no doubt it had the name Nimrud. And Beer's Nimrud, to this day, is the area where the old clay bricks have been discovered, where that tower actually was being built. The Eternal came down to see the city and the tower, which the children of men builded. And the Eternal said, "Behold, the people is one. They have all one language. And this they begin to do. And now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. Come on, let's go down and there confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech." So the Eternal scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build the city. Therefore, the name of it is called Babel, or just babbling, because the Eternal there did confound the language of all the earth, and from thence did the Eternal scatter them abroad upon the face of all the earth. You know, philology and etymology and some of those other studies are absolutely fascinating. For example, what is the name, a lot of you know, for a temple dedicated to God among the Toltecs, Aztecs, and Incas? Teocalli. T-E-O. Interesting. In Greek, the name for God is T-E-O. Theos. And among many other races, that name is found. So even though the languages are completely different, there were certain things that stayed the same. You've heard about the genie in a bottle? What is a genie? Well, it means foreign devil. Gai. Mugu Gai Pan in Chinese. Gai is a foreigner. Jin is the name for an American or any foreign devil. Gaijin. J-I-N. Gaijin. Gaijin. Like, you know, the Japanese, other people call other people by various names. And so the name in China, as well as in Japan, is Jin, J-I-N, Jin, for an evil spirit or a genie. Interesting, just a little thing in passing, but there was a complete confusion of language, and that has obtained throughout all of history until eventually during the days of the Renaissance period and even prior to that, Latin became for a time the world language from Rome. Because the educational centers, and that's where the astronomers and the astrologers and the people who studied letters and language and history and the intelligentsia and the intellectuals resided. So Latin became the world language. Later on, it was in the latter part of the Renaissance and just during the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, French became the world language. Now English is the world language. Some of the other languages in the Orient and elsewhere never did become world languages. Of course, many of them never were even written, as is true in so much of Africa and the islands of the Pacific. But of course, the Chinese have had a written language, as have the Japanese, and there are great similarities in them, but there are also very great dissimilarities. Why did God do that? Well, where is man today? Look how far we have come today. Let me remind you of Hebrews 2, verses 6 through 9. One in a certain place testified, saying, "What is man that God should pay any attention to him, that you are mindful of him, or the Son of Man, that you bother yourself with him, you visit him? You have made him a little lower than the angels." Think of that. I would dare say that if any of us in this room, including myself, were to be able to take a guided tour through a nuclear plant and have a nuclear physicist tell us exactly how it works, about those little black rods of pure uranium that are lowered down into water that are giving off such gigantic heat that the water instantly turns to steam and that the steam then propels turbines which produce electricity. And if you were to imagine that that rod of uranium can be doing that, if it's positioned just so with other rods, and how eventually when they are spent, and that water's got to be flushed out somewhere. The problem of getting rid of that radioactive waste, as you know, is a gigantic problem. And recently there was a little bit of a problem over in Japan. Some people may die and other people may suffer leukemia and other diseases as a result of that. I dare say that if you went to Detroit and went through an automobile manufacturing assembly line, that you would be amazed. I dare say if you were to study how is steel made and what proportion is iron and molybdenum and various other of the parts that are nickel and so on that go into making up stainless steel. And to understand how you get gold out of a rock by actually putting an acid on it and causing it to flow and actually melt down. There were people in metallurgy that knew these things and were smelting metals so very, very, very long ago. The ancients, way before the time of Jesus Christ, knew all about the island of Cyprus, from which came a strange metal called cuprum, which is today called copper, because that's where it was originally discovered. And they knew how to mix it with tin. What is tin? How do you find it when you kick over a rock? Is that tin? How would you know? Study that. Look it up. Look it up in an encyclopedia. Study any discipline of how man, in his ingenuity, his creativity, and his inventiveness, has managed to put together gargantuan, huge, big 747s, and even bigger airplanes than that, like the Anatol built by the Russians that are bigger than a 747, where you can put several trucks, a couple, three, four tanks, and maybe a whole, you know, half a division of men, I don't know, hundreds of men aboard them, and go soaring off into the sky, where men have built these gigantic, and some of the biggest ships today, believe it or not, are cruise vessels. Isn't that amazing? Some of the biggest ships at sea today are cruise vessels. And it was not until the building of the Queen Mary that man ever built a ship as big as the Ark. And it was made of wood. So when you think of man's achievements, when I first went down to Cape Canaveral and saw all of those missiles sitting there, the Atlas and all of those, and I said to Lyle, these men are going to do it. They're going to go to the moon. I didn't know it until I went down there. I just didn't believe they could. And millions of others were just like me. Oh, they'll never get to the moon. Well, they did. I'll never forget. I was up in Orr, Minnesota when we saw the pictures. I was down there for the launch, and I flew the Falcon up to Orr to summer camp. And by the time they got there, their journey took about, 4 days, I recall, and landed on the moon, I was sitting in the home of one of our very loyal, wonderful members up there and saw the landing on the moon. Now, that was after they had orbited the moon and come back. This was when the LEM, or the lunar lander, actually landed on the moon, and one of my distant cousins took a step, a giant leap for mankind. So I saw that and saw it happen. By the time I was back in Pasadena, I saw them on their way back. My wife will well remember. I said, come here quick and look at this. It was in the late afternoon. The sun was shining, but I could still see the moon up there. And the moon was up there, and just almost superimposed over the moon, just to one side of it, would be just a brilliant light, and it would almost disappear. And then a brilliant light, and it would almost disappear. And that was this space capsule, which was tumbling very slowly, rotating, on its way back down. And I watched it for the longest time with binoculars. I could actually see those men on their way back down to this Earth from the moon. Now, I don't want to terrify anyone, so I'll just refer to it briefly. You know that I've said for many decades now that there are enough nuclear weapons stockpiled to obliterate 20 worlds the size of ours. The same thing can now be said of chemical compounds like deadly VX, nerve gas, as well as sarin and its various derivatives, and the viruses that are deliberately being cultivated in laboratories secretly in places like Iraq and Syria and other Arab nations. I have no doubt that Egypt has its own program. In other places like Pakistan and India, in Japan and in China, you don't have any doubt of that. And in the areas of many other rogue nations, I imagine Gaddafi has got his program as well. The United States has its stockpiles, doesn't it? It always did have, because it had to have a deterrent. There's a fantastic book out, I can't remember the name of it, but it propounded the theory, and it was a novel based upon that theory, that the Germans were racing to get a hold of anthrax and even a more deadly nerve gas in the early stages of World War II. Now, you all know that Hitler was that close to an atomic bomb. And you know that if we had not bombed Peenemünde, he would have gotten it. You know that if we had not gotten Bors out of Denmark secretly and kidnapped him, he would have gotten it. You know if that loyal Swede, the poor guy that had to live with the fact that he planted a bomb aboard a ferry boat because that one heavy water shipment was going to Peenemünde and he had to blow up the entire ship, including men, women, and children, to prevent that heavy water, deuterium, from getting to that plant in Hitler's hands, or they would have perfected a low-yield, kiloton-range, dirty atomic bomb. Read that in the book called A Man Called Intrepid. Well, the story is that there was actually a cover-up. I don't think this happened, but it could have, where the United States actually released a gas like that on a group of people in the secret place where Hitler's minions were working on producing that kind of a gas, but they would know immediately what it was that had killed them, so they would be told clandestinely, without anyone else ever knowing about it, look out, because the United States has that as well. Now, you've heard about, or have you, the British getting ready for the invasion across the Channel. And one of the things that they decided to do was to run all kinds of pipelines out just barely beneath the water and fill them with all kinds of oil and gas. And they were going to turn the entirety of the channel on the shores of England, the southern shores, the areas most reachable by the boats coming across the channel, with fire. But more than that, there was also a story that came out about 50 years later that the British, in their time of extreme duress, looking at the possibility of complete overwhelmment, being overwhelmed by Hitler's forces, were going to unleash anthrax and just spray it down on those invading forces and cause hundreds of thousands of them to die with a terrible disease. Now, I'm not talking about comic books here. I'm not talking about fantasy land. I'm not talking about novels anymore. I'm saying all of these things and many more that we know nothing about do exist. They are stockpiled. They are in the hands of military organizations all over the world, and men have already proved to you and to me that they will use them. I told you before, the cult, I think you read that unleashed that sarin gas in the subways in Tokyo, were also found to have gone down to Rwanda and actually taken human blood and various other substances, human liquids, and even human flesh, and had been culturing, working up a culture of deadly Ebola virus. And they have those as well. Nations have them. So you can look at all that mankind has accomplished from one standpoint. For the next 2 hours, I could lecture on the fact that most of those things that we use, all the way from the fantastic things that we have in our automobiles today, to a GPS to guide us in flight, to plastic, to practically everything we use, was as a result of research and development, R&D, in the military. That nearly always the greatest breakthrough in all kinds of scientific achievement came about as a result of the outpouring of money and of energy and the gathering together of the greatest minds to produce vehicles and armaments and weapons and super weapons. And you know that jet aircraft came as a result of that, don't you? And so many things that we use on a day-to-day basis came as a result of military research for men trying to find ever more effective ways to completely obliterate and do in other people that they don't like. It was not really until World War II that war changed to involve total war against total populations for total stakes. Prior to that time, they were still marching up only the military facing one another in the trench warfare of World War I. Prior to that time, the British redcoats would come in about three ranks of them advancing toward a bunch of Minutemen that played dirty and hid behind trees and stumps and picked them off one by one. Prior to that time, a Persian phalanx would meet maybe Alexander's troops, and they would all just march forward shield to shield with a spear out here and a sword in their hand. And armies clashed against armies, up close, face to face, hand-to-hand combat. But inventiveness and ingenuity of mankind has meant now that we can fight virtually a cyber war. Now we see all this pristine, wonderful beauty and surgical precision sitting in front of our television set of a guided missile going right down the elevator shaft and blowing people to bits inside a communications center in Baghdad. And that's the way war is waged. Well, no more. Hitler made a mistake. I think you all know the story of why we began bombing Hitler's cities. Because it was a mistake, it really was, that the Luftwaffe bombed London. Churchill and the British were so enraged that they bombed Berlin and Hamburg and some of the cities. And then they began indiscriminately bombing cities, and so we were waging total war against men, women, and children for total stakes. And the civilian populations were those that suffered. And then you know how it came to a conclusion at the end of World War II. About 92,000 in one fell swoop in Hiroshima, and about the same number, 110,000 or so in Nagasaki. And we said, well, yes, but that saved millions of lives. It probably did in the long run, but what a horrible cost. Now, what is the most urgent, desperate need of mankind today? First, it is peace. Peace. No more war. That's the most urgent need. Secondly, it is to rid the world of endemic disease. And the only way you can do that is by getting rid of squalor and poverty, where far more than, you know, whatever, far more than any 60%, it's a far vast majority of mankind that lives in horrible squalid conditions, nowhere near like we enjoy here in America. We get irritated if we stop at a service station and the restroom is dirty. But at least in America, with all of its stink and its graffiti, it is a restroom with indoor facilities. It is not a ditch in the middle of the street. It's not a bush by the side of the road. And we're wearing shoes, and we have electricity, and we have running tap water that, even though sometimes it foams and gives off a smell, at least the various governmental agencies try to do their best to chlorinate it and put a lot of other chemicals in it so that it's a chemical soup of dead bacteria and it won't affect us very badly, because we are a very developed society. Most nations are not. The statistics on that are absolutely enormous. How far has mankind come in the search for peace, where people will just quit killing one another? Not very far. Look at East Timor. The people voted. The vast majority of them wanted to be independent. The militia, with the strings being pulled from Jakarta, didn't like that, didn't want to lose that big populated island, even though it is in squalor and poverty and disease. You look at the pictures, you know what I'm talking about. It looks like Haiti over there, just as bad. But they didn't want it to get away, didn't want it to prosper on its own. They wanted the manpower and the infrastructure such as it is. They wanted the raw materials, whatever is there. And there is, I think, a great deal of rubber. I know there's a lot of oil, primarily, in some of those islands, as well as other very valuable metals, minerals. And they didn't want to let it get away, and so you've got an absolute bloodbath. You've got black on black in Rwanda and Burundi and Central Africa and Niger and in Kenya and other places where people tend to obliterate the political opposition with bombs and knives and guns instead of at the ballot box. And right now, we are thinking of sending Americans, we already have some Americans, on the ground in East Timor. And we have them on the ground in Bosnia. We have them on the ground in Kosovo. We have them on the ground in Panama, on the ground in Haiti, and on the ground in places, especially in South Korea and in Japan, where we've got large contingents of American troops and where war can break out at any time. God said, you made him a little lower than the angels. You crowned him with glory and honor and did set him over the works of your hands. You have put all things in subjection under his feet. In that he put all in subjection under him, he left nothing that is not put under him. But now we see not yet all things put under him, but we see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels at the level of mankind for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that he by the grace of God should taste death for every man. Now I want to read something to you. This is something that is so shocking to me, because I remember people calling me and writing to me. I remember people actually appealing to me to say, why can't you write to people like Oral Roberts and Jerry Falwell and Dr. Billy Graham and the Pope and on and on and on? Why can't, if we could just get all you people together, because the problems in the world are primarily religious, ethnic, racial. They're not always just political. The political stems from those other underlying concepts that are there. The United Nations is going to unite 1,000 of the top clergymen in the entirety of the world representing every major religion on the globe. It's going to take place in Rome. It's going to take place in the year 2000. The United Nations is to extend its peacekeeping role into spiritual territory next year by hosting its first summit, this is from the London Telegraph, for world religious leaders, bringing together the likes of the Pope, the Archbishop of Canterbury, the Aga Khan, and the Grand Mufti on television. In one of the UN's most ambitious projects, more than 1,000 clergymen, from cardinals and rabbis to imams and patriarchs, will join, quote, living gods and gurus at the body's New York headquarters in August. Oh, it's in New York at first. Organizers of the Millennium World Peace Summit, called the Millennium World Peace Summit. What a name. When the millennial reign, the millennium is a term we've always used for the second coming of Christ and the beginning of Christ's 1,000 years. But now, because the clock is turning over and it's artificial, it isn't really beginning. It is the last year of the last millennium. It is not the first year of the next. But it begins to make me wonder how long all of these things can go on before God does take a hand and intervene personally. Organizers of the Millennium World Peace Summit, which will take place days before the world's political leaders gather for the UN General Assembly, hope to encourage faiths to bury ancient enmities and cooperate in resolving world conflicts. Now, as I used to say on the radio program, world government in the hands of man would be a nightmare. Would the black races tolerate a white leader? Would the white races tolerate a black leader? Would the yellow races tolerate either of the above? Would the other two tolerate a person from China or Japan as their leader? Who would be the president of the world? Look at the record of the United Nations in recent years without taking a lot of time of that. Has there ever been a Frenchman as the Secretary General? No. Has there ever been a German? No. Has there ever been an Englishman? Oh, no. Has there ever been an American? Oh, no. Can there ever be? No. Who was the very first one? Oh, he came from Norway. Who was the second one? Oh, he came from Iceland. Who was the third one? Oh, they found one down in Austria. Then they go to little nations down around Southeast Asia and find somebody. Now they got a man from a nation in Africa, Kofi Annan. And so they have all of these different races of little third world undeveloped countries that they tab for the Secretary General of the United Nations, but they dare not. Because of the political climate that obtained all the way from the close of World War II until right now, and still does obtain, really, between Russia and the United States and Britain and all of Europe and Eastern Europe and so on. They will never do that. So you cannot imagine a nation, and that's the reason why England is still not 100% cooperative with the EU, of giving up totally its sovereignty, its national identity, its race, its religion, its culture, its history, and amalgamating into one great world government. The question is always, who will rule? Do you think that the imams and the Grand Mufti and the Archbishop of Canterbury are going to recognize the Pope? Put it another way, do you think the Pope would ever recognize any of them? Oh, well, then let me just interject here for those of you that have hopes that all the various religious leaders of the more 120 split-offs in the former Worldwide Church of God are someday going to get together in a great big ecumenical meeting and choose from among them a leader. Do you think that a one of them would ever submit or subject himself to my leadership? You've got to be dreaming if you do. Now, I could ask the same question and be very honest to you and put it to me. Do you think that I would subject myself to people whose knife might still be sticking in my back? You've got to be kidding. Where do you think all this ecumenical movement is going to go? Well, all right, is this going to succeed? I think that it's very important when you look at the fact that it's in the wind today. You've got the United Nations. You've got a united Europe. You had NATO and CETO. You had the Warsaw Pact. Nations getting together. The idea is amalgamation. The idea is coalition. The idea is pooling the resources and pooling our military and pooling our R&D and our economies and all of that. Look at the fact that we have a euro now. We don't have lira and escudos and all those various currencies like the franc and the mark anymore. We got the euro. All of Europe in one common currency, and in a matter of 2 months and a few days now, it's going to be coinage right out on the street, as well as the banks dealing in the euro. So the movement is to go together. And what did God do when Nimrod tried to do that anciently? Because he knew it would rapidly accelerate. You see, the only reason it has kept man from doing what he is doing today until now has been primarily that each nation has had to go it alone. The French are working on their nuclear program. We're working on ours. Don't think the Chinese and the Japanese aren't working on theirs. You know, the Chinese have nuclear weapons, and they've got satellites in space keeping track of our movements over here. And so each nation has its own R&D and its own military infrastructure, and each one is going it alone. But if you pool it all, then you greatly accelerate the rapidity with which all these horrifying doomsday weapons can be designed. And men are not going to have peace until human nature is changed. They will never have peace so long as human nature is what it is. All right, I'll quickly try to bring this to a conclusion here. Oh, this is really priceless. The idea for the gathering emerged from a conversation between Kofi Annan, the UN Secretary General, and Ted Turner, the multimillionaire owner of CNN and the husband of Jane Fonda. Hanoi Jane, who has promised to broadcast the proceedings live. Buana Jain, the summit's New York-based executive coordinator, that's an interesting name, Bawa Jain, said, quote, Ted Turner said to the Secretary General, if you want peace in the world, you have to bring together religious leaders at the UN and get them to sign a declaration. Sure, it's peace in our time, said Chamberlain. Get them to sign a piece of paper and wave it in everybody's face. Because of the political sensitivities involved, however, the summit is being organized at one remove from Mr. Annan. It has his full backing, but he said, our dream is to get the top religious leaders to the UN so they can discuss the role they can play with the political bodies here. The gathering will not include politicians, but it should feed into the General Assembly. Against a background of friction in Kosovo, East Timor, the Middle East, and Northern Ireland, the leaders would be expected to sign a common declaration pledging their commitment to reduce religious tensions. The first ever council of senior clerics could also be established to advise the Secretary General. And its members could then be, get this, parachuted into trouble spots. Here comes the Pope. Do you believe that? Parachuted. Here comes the Archbishop of Canterbury, skirts flying, boom, you know. They're saying this seriously. We could parachute a Holy Joe, a religious sky pilot, it would really be a sky pilot this time, into a trouble spot, said Mr. Jane. And he said these leaders could go into those places physically and use their influence to make sure no violence occurs. This is man's attempt at world peace, brethren. They could say, we're not going to move from here until you make peace. Bang! What'd you do? I shot the Pope. Well, they've been trying to do that. I mean, this is unbelievable, isn't it? It's just ludicrous what people will try. Religions must exert more authority. Uh-oh. You hear that? Religions must exert more authority. Now, that'll really twang a number of people I know about. It is a call to action. While planning was still in the early stages and much was still up in the air, interest had been phenomenal and talks were underway. For example, Lambeth Palace and the Vatican. Apart from the Pope and Dr. George Kerry, religious leaders expected to be approached include Sheikh Ahmed Keftaro, the Grand Mufti of Syria, the Grand Sheikh Al-Azhar from Cairo, the Imams of the mosques of Mecca and Medina, Dr. Abdullah Saleh Obeid, the Secretary of the World Muslim League, and Israel's Chief Rabbi, Israel Meir Lau, the Ecumenical Patriarch of the Orthodox Church, the Most Reverend Bartholomew, the Russian Patriarch, His Holiness Alexei II, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and Bishop Carlos Belo, the 1996 Nobel Prize winner from East Timor. One notable absentee, however, would be the Dalai Lama. the Tibetan spiritual leader because his presence at the summit might inflame the Chinese. Now that's going to be one successful summit. Who hold one of the five permanent seats in the UN Security Council. Canon Andrew Duchar, Dr. Kerry's secretary for Anglican Community Affairs, Communion Affairs, confirmed that the archbishop was taking the summit very seriously, but was awaiting details before he would confirm his attendance. And he said it has the potential to be a very significant event, not only by bringing world leaders together in a common cause, but also bringing them into an encounter with political leaders. Barbara Smoker, the former president of the National Secular Society, said it was about time religious leaders worked for peace, but she doubted they would have very much impact. She said they have a lot to answer for. There's an element of religious conflict in practically every conflict in the world, but they won't have much influence on the majority of believers who are more motivated by ingrained emotion engendered by religion than by what their leaders say. There's a lady that knows exactly what she is talking about. Man's attempts at peace. The United Nations is an absolute paper tiger and a complete and total failure. There have been more than 65 wars since it was started. It has neither stopped nor cut short a single one of them, short of the desire of one or another of the participants to do so. And this is not going to work either. But it shows that we are in a time where the attempt at one worldism, at a new world order, at all nations pooling all of their military and their economy and their raw resources and materials together is once again in the air. That's the time in which we live. Well, as I said at the beginning, I'm here to dispel a rumor. My wife is not running for the Senate in New York. I was kidding about that. That's tongue-in-cheek, of course. But let me tell you something. I used to say time and again that I would never vote for a man in this country of mine who didn't have the wisdom of Job, wisdom of Solomon, I'm sorry, the patience of Job, and the love and mercy of Jesus Christ. Well, none of them do, and neither do I have that in any great measure at all, and neither is anyone that I know of it as a human being. The good part about it is, believe it or not, those who are going to govern cities, counties, states, this whole nation, and all the nations of England and Europe, some of them are sitting in this room. And many of them are going to see and hear this television program. And many are going to hear my voice. Why should you believe otherwise when God Almighty calls you, in His Word, the elect? You have already been elected. God has already made His selection. He's already made His choice. He has said, I want that one and that one to be a member of my family. At the Feast of Tabernacles, we acknowledge that we're here only temporarily in these physical bodies, and that we're going to eventually inherit eternity with Jesus Christ. But we also look forward to the fact that He delivers to them government, the robes of a judge, the mitre of a high priest, that they are to be rulers, judges, and that they are to actually exert authority as they are calling for these religious leaders to do. And that's the only way world peace is going to be brought, and it is by Almighty God from heaven above, and by the descending of Jesus Christ to this earth, and by the appointing of all those, He said very clearly that the 12 tribes will be governed by those 12 apostles, Matthias replacing Judas, who will sit on 12 thrones judging the tribes of Israel, and that David will be resurrected and will be a king over all of them. And Abraham, no doubt, will be above even David, maybe over many other races of this earth. And there will be plenty of jobs to go around, because the world is a rotten, filthy, wretched, sin-sick, war-torn, disease-ridden place. And the cries of human beings are so manifold and so incalculable, if you could even know of the suffering. All you can do is turn away in revulsion every single time you get up and watch television news. If you're like us, you look and you're reminded of that scripture, those that sigh and cry for the abominations that are done around them. So while we're not running for anything, I want to tell you that you and I have already been elected.